My name is Joe Tierpak. I'm one of the pastors here, and I have the privilege of preaching very often on Christmas for either our Christmas Eve service or our Christmas morning worship service. And this year, I have the great privilege of preaching both. I love Christmas, but as some of you know, I make it my goal year in and year out every time I preach to be a bit like the Grinch. I make it my goal every year to remove nostalgia and sentimentality from Christmas, at least as we remember it in this room. I love Christmas traditions, I love Christmas melodies, and I love Christmas lights and candle lights, and I'm thankful that we have so many of them here. However, I want our hearts, year in and year out, to be affected by the hard truths of Christmas, not the sentimental lights and melodies and traditions of Christmas. You can enjoy melodies, and you can enjoy lights, and you can enjoy many Christmas traditions, and never understand the truth of the biblical Christmas message. Tonight, I want our hearts to be deeply affected with hard truths that will stick to us throughout trials in days ahead. It's kind of like what you choose to eat for breakfast. I love pancakes, and it's part of our Christmas tradition to have pancakes in the morning. We love it. But by about 11 a.m., pancakes and maple syrup have kind of worn off on the substantial strength that they give everyone in the household. And so many times, you, I'm sure, have learned like me that it's much better to eat oatmeal for breakfast, even though it's not nearly as tasty. Hard, substantive truths are what we need to stick with us through trials. And Christmas sentimentality doesn't give us that, but the Christmas truth of the Bible does. I thought about it actually tonight as I was driving here. So many of us love the most famous Christmas song, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. But reality is, so many Christmases are gray and rainy, just like today, right? And I mean that not only literally, but allegorically. So many of us come around to Christmas time and we find ourselves quite gloomy, maybe depressed, maybe deeply affected by the realization of the reality in the world around us and the reality of the world inside us. And what sticks with us is not sentimentality, but truth. I read a passage tonight that is not warm and fuzzy. In fact, it is fearful. It is violent. And we read the second passage that's on the back of your program, Matthew 2, 1 through 12. Matthew records, "Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem," Bethlehem of Judea, there actually is another Bethlehem in Israel, "in the days of Herod the king," this would have been around 4 BC, "behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem." This is an entourage of political advisors, probably coming from Babylon or modern-day Iraq. They're probably traveling a distance of about 1,000 miles. Wise men, like Matthew refers to here, are referred to in the book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 2. And these would have been Nebuchadnezzar's political advisors. And they often were astrologers or dream interpreters. They were pagan men by religion, and they were men that ancient kings often superstitiously looked to for explanation of astrological events or predictions of matters of national significance. Ancient kings often looked to these kinds of wise men, just like Nebuchadnezzar did. This says that these wise men traveled probably about 1,000 miles. They come to Jerusalem and they ask, verse 2, "Where is the one who's been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose, and we have come to worship him, to pay him our homage. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. It's kind of a humorous detail, but apparently these wise men, these political advisors, didn't have a clue about politics in Jerusalem. King Herod had a monstrous reputation. He had been king by this point in history for 35 years, and everyone in Jerusalem and everyone in Israel knew him for his heavy taxation. They knew him for his massive building projects that oppressed the society, and they knew him for his insane jealousy, which led him to kill numerous family members, including one of his wives and at least three of his sons for suspicions of overthrow. Yet, these wise men, completely oblivious to the political situation in Jerusalem, come in and they ask, "Where is the newborn king?" They ask King Herod, "Where is the newborn king?" Verse 4 says that King Herod assembled all the chief priests and the scribes of the people. These were the religious leaders. And he asked where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea." Because that's what's written by the prophet Micah. And they quote from Micah chapter 5. This had been written about 7 centuries earlier. "And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, because from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel." That prophecy was written 700 years before Jesus came. When Herod goes to the scribes, they point back to this ancient prophecy, and they say, "He's probably in Bethlehem." So verse 7 says, "Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go, search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I may come and worship him as well.'" Yeah, right. "After they heard the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose, it went before them again until it came to rest over the place where the child was." This verse seems to indicate that the star that these wise men saw, that these wise men were led by, was not what many have suggested for the last 500 or 600 years in church history. Some have suggested that it might be a comet or an alignment of planets or maybe a supernova or something like that. I don't think it was. What we just read seems to indicate that this star was something probably more like what God led the people of Israel with in the Old Testament. A pillar of fire by night, a cloud by day. These kinds of miraculous wonders that were a little bit more in the immediate presence of the people who were being led. Anyway, it says that when the Magi again saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshiped him. Mark that word, him. They worshiped only the child, not either of his parents. Then opening their treasuries, their gifts, they offered gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These were 3 highly expensive and highly valued gifts. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country along another route. They went around Jerusalem to avoid Herod's palace and his violent anger. This is the second chapter of Matthew. And when we start reading right here in chapter 2, it's a bit like when you go into a theater and you sit down and you're late and you've missed the first 10 minutes of the movie. It's not fun for anyone, right? You want to catch the first 10 minutes. What happened that really sets the stage for the story? Well, in the first chapter of the book, Matthew has recorded Jesus' ancestry, his genealogy, And he's also recorded how Jesus was miraculously born to a young virgin named Mary. That's what took place in the chapter before this. And Matthew actually records that introduction to Jesus, that grand introduction to Jesus, to show us that Jesus is none other than God in flesh. He is God become man. Matthew is actually writing to identify that Jesus has royal blood. That's why he records the genealogy. Jesus can be the one that has been promised for 2,000 years, promised to Abraham and promised to David in particular. He is bearing royal blood, so he can be royalty, he can be the king. And he records the miraculous virgin birth to show that Jesus is the Lord who has come to save his people from their sins. That's how the first chapter ended. This is one who is fully God and fully man, and he has come on a saving mission, a mission to save people from sins. What Matthew does here now, 10 minutes in, what he does here is he shows us initially the ways that people react to the king. In chapter 2, Matthew does what many ancient writers do when they record biographies or when they record histories. They pick out two examples of opposing reactions to some figure. And they say, you can either be like this or you can be like this. And that's exactly what Matthew does here. He says, this is how you can react to the king. Matthew's point here is to record reactions. And he basically says, here's the main point. He says, you either react to the king by worshiping him like these clueless wise men, or you reject him like Herod and everyone else who lives in fear of Herod. As one scholar summarized it, he said, Matthew contrasts the eagerness of the wise men to worship, despite their limited knowledge, with the apathy of the Jewish leaders and with the hostility of Herod's court. These two reactions, worship and rejection, or submission and hostility, these two reactions were the exact same reactions that Jesus experienced all throughout his life. They were the exact same reactions that all throughout the rest of the New Testament, people experienced as the gospel confronted them, as the gospel message of King Jesus confronted them. This characterized the two ways that you could react, and it's still the way people react today. To put it bluntly, most political leaders and most religious people and most common people still reject Jesus of Nazareth, while a few relatively ignorant people, mostly Gentiles, are drawn to worship him. That's what Matthew is picturing. That's the main point. And all I want to do is explore those two reactions, and then we'll sing again. The first reaction is this. Beware, or the first message based on these reactions is this. Beware of reacting to Jesus with rejection. Beware of reacting to Jesus with rejection. Matthew portrays Herod, the religious leaders, and then all of Jerusalem rejecting Jesus. Herod rejects him out of selfish jealousy. He doesn't want to give up the throne. Ironically, the religious leaders ignore him, and the whole city of Jerusalem rejects him out of fear. Fear of the repercussions of what may come if they align with King Jesus rather than King Herod. Whatever the reason, no matter which of those groups you fall in, the overarching response that Matthew portrays is one of rejection. And everyone, I think every one of us, if we're going to acknowledge reality, is going to acknowledge that we by nature fit one of these profiles of rejection. That includes me. I'm not distancing myself from my message. No one comes into the world welcoming King Jesus, welcoming the king's authority. I know what I'm saying and what I'm about to say is quite harsh, but it's reality. Most of us are mini Herods. That's the way Karl Lafferten puts it. He explains what he means when he says we're mini Herods. He says, we just by nature resist Jesus' rule. I can give a couple examples. Thomas Nagel, a well-known philosophy professor at New York University, he puts it bluntly. He says, I want atheism to be true. It isn't just that I don't believe in God. I hope there's no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. And he says, my guess is that this cosmic authority problem is not rare. In other words, he says, I'm not the only one who struggles like this. I really appreciate Nagel's honesty. What bothers all of us about God or about a king is authority. What bothers us about Jesus is that he wants to control our lives. None of us welcomes that naturally. He wants to rule over us. He wants to govern us and every aspect of us. He wants to govern our thoughts and our attitudes. He wants to govern our relationships, even our sexuality. No, my privacy is my private. No, Jesus wants to govern every part of your life. Jesus wants to govern your speech. He wants to govern your reactions. He wants to govern every part of you. Does that make you feel uncomfortable? C.S. Lewis was a bit like Thomas Nagel. He puts it basically the same way in his testimony. He says, before I became a Christian, God to me was the great interferer. He wanted to interfere in my life. All of us come into this world with hearts very much like Herod's, not as full-blown, but hearts very much like Herod's. We reject Jesus' authority because we don't want to give up the throne that we think we're sitting on. I just point out the other two ways that you can reject Jesus. Many people ironically reject Jesus like the religious leaders did. They rejected him out of self-righteousness. And many reject out of fear, like the citizens of Jerusalem did. We may not be as controlled by jealousy for control, as Herod, but we might be very much controlled by self-righteousness or by fear. So many of us are just like the scribes, aren't we? We don't think of ourselves as sinners. What? I'm a good person. I know the Bible. I've grown up in church. And these are excuses for why we don't need Jesus. As the old proverb says, the nearer the church, the farther from God. So often true. We avoid God by being religious. We think that we can control him by our religion rather than letting him control us. Others are more like the citizens in Jerusalem, controlled by fear. And they're afraid of what might happen if they chose to worship Jesus. Submitting to the king would disrupt their sense of peace and stability. It would potentially invite discord in their relationships, persecution, ostracism from the people whose approval they care about. These are ways that people reject Jesus. And Matthew says, look at everyone rejecting King Jesus. No matter what the underlying cause for our rejection of King Jesus, whether it's a jealous hunger for control, or whether it's more like we're self-righteous and we think we're okay without him, or whether we're more like the citizens of Jerusalem and we're just afraid of the repercussions in our relationships if we accept him, no matter what the reason, there is one major problem with any kind of rejection, and that is reality. Jesus is king. And we can't do anything about it. Whether we respond rightly to him or not, he's still king. Tri-County, it's okay to cheer. He's king. And it doesn't matter whether we respond or not. He's king. And one day, every individual is going to acknowledge it, whether we do so willingly or unwillingly. The fact is that Jesus was really born. And he was really born in keeping with prophecy. And he was really born in a certain family and in a certain way that proved that he was God in flesh, that proved that he was God's chosen king. And he died and he rose again to prove over and over and over again he's king, and no one can stop him from being king. Death can't even hold him. He's king. You can't ultimately reject Jesus' authority. You can reject it for a time, but eventually you have to deal with reality. The first potential reaction to King Jesus is rejection, and I say beware of it. The second wise reaction to King Jesus is submission. And this is what Matthew pictures with these wise men. The right response to King Jesus is worship. It's paying homage like the wise men do. That these guys worship Jesus is ironic to the point of being funny. I don't say Matthew wrote this with a humorous intent, but what he says should cause all of us to chuckle a little bit. These guys are Babylonian Gentiles. They're pagan astrologers. They know who the Jews are, but they don't know the Old Testament. And they're clueless when it comes to understanding the last four decades of politics in Jerusalem. But they get one thing right. They get the one thing that matters in life right. What is the one thing that matters? They submit themselves to King Jesus. By God's drawing with a star, they search long and hard for the king. Some of you have done that. Some of you may need to do that. Go on a search to figure out whether the Bible's claims regarding Jesus can be verified, whether there is substantive proof to throw your life on the mercy of King Jesus and give your life to King Jesus as your personal king. Some of you may need to go on that search. Maybe you need to start it tonight. Matthew also portrays these wise men as, by God's protection, finding King Jesus. Herod could have said, I'm going to go to Bethlehem and find him, and he could have just executed these people who wanted to worship someone other than him. But by God's protection, these men actually found the king. And when they found him, by God's grace, they submitted themselves to him. They bowed themselves before King Jesus, and then they gave generously out of their wealth to him. Matthew is portraying a powerful picture of the right response to King Jesus. It's the right response for everyone. And Matthew opens and closes his book with this kind of response. At some point in the future, you may want to read Matthew chapter 28, where we're shown two pictures of people seeing Jesus after his resurrection and worshiping him. Or in one account, verse 9, they take hold of his feet and worship him. At his birth, the right response was worship the king. After his resurrection, the right response was worship the king. And whether it was 2,000 years ago or whether it's tonight, the right response to King Jesus is submit your life to him. Bow before him. Honor him as your one and only king. That's the right response that Matthew's driving at. If you respond to King Jesus with submission, you're wise. No matter where you come from, no matter what your job or your background, no matter if you've earned any religious degrees, no matter how chaotic your life, if you have submitted yourself to King Jesus, you're wise. it will go eternally well with you, no matter how it's going for you today. If you have responded to King Jesus with worshipful submission, you're a Christian, you're a follower of Jesus, a disciple. And my encouragement to you is don't stop. Keep submitting your life to him. Keep submitting every part of your life to him. Keep growing day by day in submitting yourself worshipfully to the King, to God's chosen King. Keep on honoring him with every part of your life. If you respond to King Jesus with rejection, whether that's rejecting him out of selfish desire to be your own authority, or out of self-righteousness because you don't think you're bad enough to need his help, or whether you reject him out of fear, a fear of self-preservation, no matter which of these reasons is behind your rejection, the message of Matthew is a sobering one. You're not wise. You're foolish. Doesn't matter how powerful you are, how much money you have. It doesn't matter how educated you are, how religious you are, or how comfortable your life is. The only people who are wise are the ones who submit to King Jesus. I hope that some of you in here tonight acknowledge that to this point in your life, you've been rejecting King Jesus. You've been excusing it for this or that reason. And you need tonight to turn and submit to the King. You need to find him and bow before him and give yourself to him. The good news for you is that Jesus was not only born to rule you, as Carl Lafferten puts it, he was born to rescue you. He was born to rescue you from your rebellion against his rule. That's wondrous. He actually died for your deviance. He died for your disobedience. He died so that if you would turn from your rebellion and submit your life to him, you could be forgiven. The King came not only to rule, but to save, to rescue. I've quoted Carl twice. He's written a great little book on Christmas called Christmas Uncut. And I just end with his description of his own life. He says, "I can still remember the evening several years ago when someone asked me, 'What are you going to do about Jesus?' He said, by that point, I'd already understood for a while what really happened and that Jesus really existed, that he lived and he really died in history. He rose again. And slowly, I had come to see that these were not just historical details, but that Jesus' life really mattered to me personally, but I hadn't done anything about it. It had made no difference to my day-to-day life or to my future." He says, "until that friend of mine came and said to me, 'What are you going to do about Jesus?' He says it was a blunt question, but I suddenly realized that it had an obvious answer. I needed to repent and believe, to accept Jesus as my ruler and rescuer. It was no good just knowing about Jesus. I needed to actually know him, to start following and trusting in and speaking to and listening to him." He says, "it was the most important decision I ever made. In many ways, it's a decision that has made my life much more difficult, but in every way, it has made my life more fulfilling, more satisfying, more exciting. Looking back, it was easily the best decision I ever made." What better time to be confronted with the right reaction to the birth of the King than on Christmas Eve.